You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
Hey, Prestigeheads, it's Derek, and I am here to let you guys know, if you haven't already heard, that friend of the show, Spencer Ackerman, we've had him on several times, and as you may know, he is writing the current run of Iron Man for Marvel Comics. We had him on the show to talk about that, actually, a while back. The first volume of his run has been compiled. It is now available for purchase in paperback, all the issues of the first volume, which is called The Stark Rocks on War. Spencer has been doing a bang-up job. I've been reading the comics. I haven't read comics since, it's been a long time. Let's just leave it at that. But I've been loving the work he's doing on this. He is really doing a great job. And as he said when he was on here, but I'll say it again, if you're a fan of Spencer's work or if you're a fan of this show, then you are going to love some of the themes that he touches on here. Blowback, corporate domination, global arms markets, surveillance capitalism, mass incarceration. It touches on a lot of things that I know people really care about. So, and it does a fantastic job, as I said. So if you want to check it out, we're going to have a link in the show description with a number of places that you can purchase. Again, it's volume one of Spencer's run on Iron Man, all compiled in a nice little paperback form. So please check it out. Thanks.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And as usual, we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's just jump headfirst into the pool of the news. And let's start with this really inspiring report regarding 2024 global military spending.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn it had gone up. Go figure. I didn't realize.
I would not have guessed that. What are the odds on it going down? Like at Vegas, like people bet on everything, man, like now.
Yeah, you could probably make book on that.
Like a billion to one.
Never actually declines. Somebody's going to win big on that bet.
Contact FanDuel.
The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, which is the main organization that does this sort of thing, tracks military spending around the world, released its report on 2024 on Monday. And yeah, it turns out that humanity spent a lot more on the military matters in 2024 than we did in 2023. Spending rose by 9.4% to around $2.718 trillion. In what the report says was the steepest year-on-year rise since at least the end of the Cold War. May also come as no surprise that the U.S. still makes up the vast, a sizable plurality of that money, with our military budget approaching $1 trillion a year, all on our own. But most of the increase, it sounds like, was driven by higher spending in Europe and the Middle East. Europe, somewhat understandable given the situation in Ukraine. A lot of European countries are, and the Donald Trump situation, I guess, a lot of NATO members also looking to boost their defense spending, either to potentially account for a U.S. pullout from Europe or to impress Donald Trump enough that he won't pull out from Europe. The top five global spenders, which is the United States, China, Russia, Germany, and India, all remained the top five spenders. They account for most of the total spending, about $1.6 trillion combined.
All right, Derek, let's move on to Israel-Palestine, and let's talk about what's happening in Gaza in terms of the starvation there.
The World Food Program announced on Friday that it is fully out of food in Gaza. It said its last remaining food stocks to its kitchens around the territory. It's been nearly 2 months, I think, at this point, since the Israeli military imposed a full blockade on humanitarian aid getting into Gaza, not even pretending at this point to facilitate it as they were doing previously. Amazingly, there's been considerably, I think, less global outcry about this than there was before the truce, when there was substantial outcry. A lot of that was, maybe led by voices in the United States that are no longer, quite so loud, either because of the change in administration or because the current administration is deporting anybody who goes to a pro-Palestine protest, or it's trying to. There's a number of reasons for this. Mark Lynch, who's a commentator on Middle East affairs, wrote in his newsletter that there's another potential reason here, which is that people are just benumbed to all of this at this point. And it seems like just business as usual, which I think is pretty damning for all concerned, but we are at a point where starvation is a serious possibility again, more so given that the Israelis have just flat out said they're not letting anything in and won't do so until they have some kind of deal with Hamas, or they make alternate arrangements, which they may be trying to do at this point.
All right, Derek, and what about this move of people into Rafah?
Right. This is the potential alternate arrangement. The Israeli media claimed over the weekend, and Israeli officials have said this a few times, that they're creating, or suggested a few times at least, that they want to create a new humanitarian zone on the site of whatever used to be Rafah and its environment. Most of it has been destroyed by the Israeli military, and there are reports from residents of southern Gaza who say that the IDF has come through and started flattening the rubble and the remains of what is left of Rafah. The Israelis have cut off Rafah. They've with their new security corridor, the Morag security corridor, they've cut Rafah off from the rest of Gaza. So the idea, in theory, would be to herd everybody, the civilian population, theoretically, the civilian population of Gaza, into this area, into where Rafah once was. They would set up, whatever meager accommodations I imagine they could set up for displaced persons. Aid could theoretically be brought in. It would be done most likely by private contractors rather than by international organizations, because the Israelis have quit working with the UN and other international aid providers altogether. So they would probably employ private companies to do this. And that would enable the Israelis, or allow them, I think, to justify turning the rest of Gaza into essentially a free fire zone. Anybody who isn't in Rafah from whatever point forward would be considered an enemy combatant ipso facto, whether they are or not, whether they were able to get to Rafah and chose not to, or were unable to get into Rafah, were unable to make that move and are stuck in place. It doesn't matter. They would be considered enemy combatants and therefore fair game. The Israelis could then say that they're trying to do something about the humanitarian needs of these people. They would also, of course, a little ancillary benefit, I guess, they would also be very close to the Egyptian border. And if it turned out that, say, somebody wanted to implement Donald Trump's ethnic cleansing plan, they would be positioned conveniently for something like that to get them out of the territory with relatively little logistical lift.
So, Derek, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which you don't hear much about these days, is making moves. Tell us about this new office they've created.
So the PLO created several days ago a new vice chairman role on the executive committee, and that the person who occupies that role would also serve as the vice president of the Palestinian Authority, or whatever passes for a government in the West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas, the president, the chair of the PLO and the president of the Palestinian Authority, named a close confidant named Hussein al-Sheikh to fill that post. This is as close, I think, as he will get to designating his choice as heir or successor
Abbas is quite old, not in great health, extraordinarily unpopular on top of that. And so this puts Sheikh in the position of basically having been identified by Abbas as the man he wants to lead things when he's no longer around. It's unclear, you know, the successor, once Abbas passes, or if he would suddenly decide to retire, although I don't know why he would do that at this point. He's hung on long enough to, you know, for that to be an impossibility. But once he's not in the picture anymore, the PLO would choose a successor. They don't have to necessarily just promote Sheikh to that position, although he would presumably serve in some interim capacity. So it's not a given that he would succeed Abbas. But certainly this is an expression of Abbas's wishes. Abbas is, of course, as I said, extremely unpopular. Sheikh, I don't think, is terribly popular. His role with the PLO has been liaising with the Israelis, which you know, marks him as a certain type of person to a lot of Palestinians in the West Bank. And the fact that he's been identified by Abbas as the man he wants to succeed, it probably is a black mark as well against him. So I don't know that he's terribly popular either, but it is significant in this moment where we're trying to figure out what a Palestinian entity might look like moving forward, whatever that might be, whatever the Israelis might allow it to be. There's been a lot of demands from Israel, from the United States, from other Arab countries, the UAE in particular, for reform within the PLO, within the Palestinian Authority. Abbas appointing a successor may be a sign that he's, you know, sort of open to the idea of change, that he wants to assure everybody that there's going to be
a robust 98.
So, you know, I mean, I think there's a geopolitical message here as well, although the UAE, which has been the big driver of the quote-unquote reform within the PLO, has its own man, Mohammed Dahlan, who used to be the PLO's man in Gaza, and who is basically a client of Mohammed bin Zayed, the leader of the UAE. They would very much like Dahlan to run things in the Palestinian Authority moving forward after Abbas is gone. So they're not going to be terribly thrilled with Sheikh. And one could argue that Abbas made this appointment in part to kind of block Dahlan's accession in any sort of, you know, open succession process, because they do not get along at all. So, you know, there's a lot of things to consider. I don't think Sheikh is a done deal as a successor to Abbas, but, you know, certainly points in a certain direction.
Let's move on to Syria, and let's talk about the violence that has occurred between security forces and Druze militias.
There have been at least two days of clashes between Syrian security forces and Druze militias around Damascus, and then apparently also in Sueda province in southern Syria. The first night involved security forces. And when I say security forces, this could also mean some of their jihadist or post-jihadist, I guess is the term that some people are trying to use, compatriots from the Syrian rebel movement, entering a predominantly Druze suburb community around Damascus called Jaramana, and clashing with Druze militia fighters, internal Druze security forces there. At least 17 people were killed in that incident. That was on Monday into Tuesday. Then Tuesday night into Wednesday, there was a second clash in the town of Sahnaya, which is near Damascus. Also, large Druze population. Again, security forces seem to have entered the town. There was some kind of battle. Around 22 people killed in that clash at last count. That last time I saw anything, that may be outdated. Now on Thursday, Druze leaders are saying that there was some sort of ambush in Sueda, as I mentioned earlier, in which 27 at least Druze gunmen were killed, many of them in the initial ambush, and then there was some fighting after that, I presume. This is all based on the release of a recording in which a Syrian Druze person allegedly insults the Prophet Muhammad, which prompted the security forces. And as I say, they may not have been acting as strictly as security forces. They may have been acting as jihadist extremists, which is what they are or were, at least before they got the state imprimatur, entering these neighborhoods and going after, trying to find the person responsible for this recording, or just going after Druze in general, in the same way that they've gone after Alawites previously. So, you know, there's a lot that's still unknown about this. The Syrian government has said it will investigate. But it's investigating, I think, mainly the recording, not the violence by the state security forces. The Israeli government got involved because the Israeli government has appointed itself as the protector of Syrian Druze, whether Syrian Druze like it or not. They conducted airstrikes on Wednesday, possibly related to the situation in Suwaid, although I'm not sure. But they claimed they conducted airstrikes that were warning shots effectively against a group that was planning to attack a Druze community. So I'm not sure what they didn't go into much detail. But, you know, nevertheless, this ropes the Israelis into Syria a little tighter than they already were. Yeah, we'll just have to see if things calm down. The Druze communities in southern Syria and the Syrian government do have an agreement in place to kind of incorporate Druze militias and those institutions into the state. Obviously, they haven't been implemented yet, and this is going to create more roadblocks to that. And then you can be sure that other communities around the country are watching this. The Kurds in the northeast, the Alawites, who are already, you know, already know that they're targeted by these security forces and their auxiliaries, you know, are going to be watching what happens here very closely, I think.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Yemen, where the United States has bombed a migrant center.
The Houthis are claiming, they claimed on Monday that the U.S. overnight had bombed a migrant detention center in Sada province, which is in northern Yemen, kind of the Houthi heartland, killing at least 68 people. There's been no comment on this from the U.S. military, which has instead been bragging about all the targets it's bombed without getting into the possibility of civilian casualties. Only claiming that they've killed nothing but Houthi fighters, no civilians. This is very near, and you know, I guess this is probably unsurprising, but the site of this detention center is very near a migrant detention center that the Saudis bombed during their air campaign over northern Yemen a few years ago, killing also dozens of people. What these centers are for? You know, I don't want to paint a picture of like, you know, humanitarian consideration here on the part of the Houthis. They intercept migrants who are crossing Yemen, who come over from the Horn of Africa and cross Yemen to try and enter Saudi Arabia for work. Many, you know, those who can afford it can kind of bribe their way through or get, you know, paid passage through Houthi territory to Saudi Arabia. Those who cannot may wind up in one of these detention facilities and then, of course, have the privilege of being bombed by the United States in its futile efforts, really, to do anything about Houthi attacks on Israel or Red Sea shipping.
And what about the Houthis shooting down drones?
Yeah, they shot down last week another Reaper drone, an MQ-9 U.S.-made Reaper drone. That makes 7 of them since the U.S. military resumed its bombing campaign over Yemen in the middle of March. Those things cost about $30 million a pop, which makes for around over $200 million that the Houthis have cost the Pentagon just in the form of these drones that they keep shooting down. And I think if you compared that to the total amount of ordnance that the Houthis have fired on Red Sea shipping, on Israel, the ballistic missiles that they fired over the entire course of their efforts to kind of force a resolution in Gaza, you would probably come out at around that figure. So maybe a little bit higher, a little bit lower, I don't know. But it's clear. It highlights, I think, the disparity in terms of the amount of resources, the amount of money that the United States is throwing into bombing northern Yemen without apparently knowing what it's bombing migrant centers that have nothing to do with any kind of military target. as opposed to what the Houthis are doing and having no effect on the threat to Red Sea shipping, having no effect. The Houthis are still firing ballistic missiles at Israel. Like, this, the bombing has done nothing. But, you know, the U.S. military continues at it. And since it's Candyland, they don't have to worry about, budgetary constraints or anything like that. But that's where things stand.
All right, Derek, let's talk about Iran suspending the fourth round of nuclear talks, or at least postponing them.
Yeah, this has just developed as we were recording. I'm not entirely sure what happened. The U.S. and Iran have had three sessions now negotiating potentially a new nuclear accord. They haven't gotten very far. They've been indirect talks mediated by the Omani government. There was supposed to be, at least there was talk after last Saturday's third session, of a fourth session this coming Saturday. The Iranians, as late as Wednesday, Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister, seemed to indicate that those talks were going ahead. He had made plans even to meet with European representatives on Friday to kind of brief them on what was going on ahead of the talks with the U.S. And then on Thursday, it just kind of seems to have fallen apart. The Omani government announced a postponement for what they called logistical reasons. That sounds like something you say when you don't really want to talk about the real reasons. So we don't know. They didn't go. The Omani foreign minister, Badr al-Busaidi, didn't go in any details when he announced the postponement. The Iranians are saying that they have postponed the talks at the request of Oman's foreign minister. Interestingly, the AP is citing an anonymous person familiar with the U.S. negotiating team who says that the Americans never actually confirmed that they were going to participate in a fourth round of talks. So this may be on the U.S. side. It's also possible that it's on Iran's side. Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, made some very kind of threatening statements toward the Iranians on Wednesday about Iranian support for the Houthis that may have irritated the Iranians enough to say we're going to call a pause on things. But I don't know. I don't know where things stand. We still don't have a lot of detail. This is very much a developing story. But it looks like there will not be a fourth round on Saturday. Maybe there will be one in the future. Who knows?
Let's move on to India, where a lot has been going on. So maybe let's start with the potential for military action.
Right. We talked last week about the terrorist attack in Kashmir, the deadliest attack against civilians there in many, many years. I think go all the way back about 20 years to find one that was as deadly. The situation continues to deteriorate. India and Pakistan have closed their airspace to each other. They've closed their border. They've threatened to withdraw from a number of treaties. India, from most provocatively, from the Indus Waters Treaty, has suspended, allegedly, its involvement in the Indus Waters Treaty. What that means is not entirely clear, and it will take a while to manifest, but that's a potentially existential issue. For Pakistan, the Pakistanis have threatened to withdraw from the Simla agreement, which was formed or agreed to in the early 1970s, that established the line of control between Indian and Pakistani-controlled Kashmir. So that's another very provocative step that the Pakistanis go through with that. They have engaged, Indian and Pakistani forces have engaged in what I think is basically small arms fire across the line of control for several nights running. AFP reported on Tuesday that Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, has basically given his military the green light to respond to last week's terrorist attack. Now, that attack was launched by Lashkar-e-Taiba, or an offshoot group, which is a Kashmiri militant group that has carried out attacks in India and in Kashmir in the past, that has ties, past ties at least, to the Pakistani intelligence and military establishment. And consequently, the Indians are just blaming this attack on Pakistan. Pakistani officials say they had nothing to do with it. Those denials may ring a little bit hollow given the past relationship with LET. We don't really know. But as I say, the Indians are going down this road pretty hell-bent on blaming Pakistan. The information minister in the Pakistani government, Atullah Tarar, early Wednesday morning went on social media to claim that there is credible intelligence, that was the term he used, that India intends to launch a military strike within the next 24 to 36 hours. We're still in that window, I believe. By the time people listen to this, I don't think we will be. So either the attack will have taken place or he will have perhaps exaggerated a bit. But things are very much on a knife's edge and something could break, I think, pretty much any time.
All right, we'll keep you all updated with that. Let's move on to China, where Trump has claimed that he's had a phone call with Xi.
Yeah, this is getting very bizarre. Donald Trump has claimed several times over the past few weeks that he's in conversation with Xi Jinping, that Xi has called him, that there are active negotiations taking place between the U.S. and China, which the Chinese government, the foreign ministry, the commerce ministry, continually deny and say, no, there really isn't any contact. We're not talking. There's been no phone call. So I don't know if they're massaging the facts somewhat. And they have the statements that I've read from the Chinese government do include some caveats, like you get a foreign ministry spokesman saying, as far as I know, there's been no contact, or there's been no recent contact. So there's some weasel words in there that they could be using to obfuscate things. Or the alternative is that Donald Trump is hallucinating that he had a phone call with Xi Jinping, which I think is equally troubling if that's the case. But, you know, anything's possible. If there are conversations taking place, they don't seem to be going anywhere. So the net effect is basically they might as well not be talking. The U.S. still has 145% tariffs on Chinese products, most of them entering the U.S. China still has, you know, 125%, I think, retaliatory tariffs on U.S. products. The Chinese government is also telling people, basically issuing warnings about hard economic times to come. The Financial Times reported this week that they were assuring the public that we can do without American farm products, American energy products. So clearly hunkering down, it sounds like, for the long haul. Although the Washington Post reported just today that there are indications that China is reaching out a little bit more strenuously to try and arrange some kind of negotiations. There was evidence this week that the tariffs and this kind of forced rapid decoupling is having negative effects on both economies. Manufacturing was reportedly down in China last month, fairly substantially contracted. The manufacturing sector actually contracted a bit last month, which is probably an indication of, you know, what happens when China is no longer exporting items to the United States. The U.S. economy as a whole contracted in the first quarter of 2024, which may not have just only to do with China. The whole back and forth with tariffs and not doing tariffs, and, you know, Trump waking up one day and having a different tariff policy than he had the day before, which caused the markets to go into meltdown a number of times. The whole thing is kind of cumulatively, I think, affecting the U.S. economy. But it did shrink by 0.3% in the first quarter as compared to 2.4% growth in the last quarter of 2024. So, you know, there's some concern, I think, on the part of the Trump administration as well, that they need to kind of settle things down. And one way to do that would be to get some kind of trade agreement with China that lowers the tariffs, wouldn't remove them entirely, I don't think, but could lower them to perhaps more manageable levels. But as I say, no progress seems to be going on in that direction.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
Let's move on to South Korea and talk about this court ruling.
This just came through before we recorded, so I haven't had a chance to really digest it all. But Lee Jae-myung, the leader, former leader, I guess, of the Democratic Party, who lost the 2022 presidential election to the now deposed, impeached, and removed Yoon Suk-yeol, and was considered easily the front runner to win the snap election to replace him, Lee has now been has had a not guilty verdict. The Supreme Court of South Korea threw out a not guilty verdict in a trial that he was involved in allegedly making false statements during a previous campaign, which amounted to election fraud or violation of election law. A lower court had ruled in March or had cleared him of those charges in March. And now the Supreme Court has stepped in and said, no, this, we're throwing that verdict out and sending it back for potential retrial. So this could completely upend the snap election. As I said, Lee was by far the front runner in polling to succeed Yoon. It's now unclear if he's going to be able to run at all. By the time I think the snap election's supposed to take place on June 3rd, so that's not a lot of time to retry that case. And if it's still hanging out there, or if he is found guilty, certainly. If they do get through the trial and he's convicted, he won't be allowed to run at all. If the trial is still ongoing, then, that's going to seriously impact his ability to run or what people may think of him going into the election. So it could be a major upheaval now in this process, as I say, something that just happened. So I'm still kind of looking at what's going on here.
All right, let's move on to Nigeria, where there's been an increase in violence.
Local officials in northeastern Nigeria, particularly in Borno province, which is the center of this, but also in surrounding areas, are talking about a surge that they're seeing in jihadist violence from both Boko Haram and Islamic State West Africa province, which is an offshoot and rival of Boko Haram. And this tracks with, like, I think, increasing frequency of reports out of that region that of attacks happening almost on a daily basis at this point in various parts of the region. There's a couple of things going on here, apparently, at least according to these local officials. One is that Islamic State and Boko Haram, which, as I say, have been rivals for quite some time and went to war with one another not that long ago. Boko Haram came out very much on the worst end of that. They seem to have called some sort of a truce between them. They're not collaborating necessarily, but they're also not fighting each other in the same, certainly at least to the same degree that they were a couple of years ago. And that has allowed Islamic State to focus, I think, more attention on attacking Nigerian security forces and on attacking civilians. And it's allowed Boko Haram really to rebuild itself. That's been the big driver, I think, is that Boko Haram seems to be in a much stronger position, not just in Nigeria, but in the Lake Chad area in general, which includes southeastern Niger, it includes parts of Chad, it includes some of the surrounding countries, Cameroon, also along the Cameroonian border. I think that group has been able to really kind of do some recruiting and do some strengthening of its capabilities and has gotten back to the point where it can also be carrying out fairly frequent attacks. Now, it's probably only a matter of time before these two groups start battling each other again, if Boko Haram is really surging. But in the meantime, the brunt of this is being borne by civilians in the region and Nigerian security forces.
So let's talk about the fact that the Congolese and Rwandan foreign ministers have set a deadline for a peace deal.
Yeah, this is an event last Friday. The foreign ministers of both countries went to Washington and met with Marco Rubio. And I don't know if it was Rubio's charming mediation abilities or just their desire to get the hell away from him. But they agreed to what they called a declaration of principles in which they committed. I actually want to read this whole thing. They committed to coordinating through existing channels to generate an initial peace draft agreement for the participants' mutual review no later than May 2nd. I think that gives you a sense of how far off this may be, because I don't know when the last time you committed to coordinate to generating something was, Danny, but it's been a while for me, and it didn't go very well. That's a lot of, a lot of weasel language to get through. But the upshot, at least, is this is an opening toward potentially resolving the M23 conflict in the eastern DRC. There's been a ceasefire more or less in place there for a few weeks now. There have been negotiations that were brokered first by the Qataris and then now this Rubio process between M23 and the Congolese government directly, and also between the Rwandans and the Congolese, Rwanda being the main foreign patron of M23, and the Congolese government really doesn't see any distinction between the Rwandans and the militants. So, despite the loaded language, this seems like a positive development. The deadline, as I said, was May 2nd. So by the time people are listening to this, we will probably know whether or not they were able to actually produce an initial draft peace agreement. We'll see how it goes.
Let's turn to Russia-Ukraine, and let's start with the fact that it appears the Kursk operation is over.
This has been kind of verging. It's been verging on full defeat for a while now. According to Russian media, Vladimir Putin over the weekend congratulated his military commanders for their victory in driving the Ukrainians out of Kursk. The Ukrainians are continuing to insist that they still have a military presence on the Russian side of the border, but it does sound like they were in control of two. Their area of control had shrunk to two border villages, and then they lost one of those. It sounds like they'd lost the other one at this point as well. So any anchor that they had in terms of an actual population center that they were holding on to is gone. If they're not fully kicked out of Kursk at this point, it's would only be a matter of time. And effectively, it sounds like they have been. There have been reports of Russian forces actually crossing into Sumy Oblast in Ukraine on the other side of the border, attacking villages attacking Ukrainian villages, potentially to set up, at the very least, some kind of buffer zone along the border to prevent another Ukrainian incursion and to give the Russians another, foothold in another Ukrainian province that could wind up, playing a role if there are peace talks. Who knows? Whether we're actually going to get to that point. There's been a lot of back and forth in that regard.
So the Pope continues to shape things from heaven. Let's talk about Trump and Zelensky meeting at his funeral.
Yeah, if he's ever going to be canonized, they could probably cite this as one of his miracles. Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and Donald Trump both attended Pope Francis' funeral on Saturday. Met on the sidelines before the ceremony. There were photographs sitting in chairs, kind of talking to one another. And in keeping with his basic principle that Donald Trump believes and listens to whatever is the last thing he's heard about any particular situation, Trump came away from that meeting with Zelensky with a significantly, it seemed like, altered sense of the conflict. He told reporters that he was kind of frustrated with the fact that the Russians were continuing to attack Ukraine and continuing to, as he put it, shoot missiles into civilian areas in Ukraine. He questioned whether Putin, in his words, was tapping him along in their discussions about a ceasefire or about potential negotiations. He said, maybe, it makes me think that maybe Putin doesn't want to stop the war. So a lot of language that we haven't seen out of Trump yet, expressing frustration with Vladimir Putin and the Russians. He even threatened to impose new sanctions on Russia. So seemingly a shift. We'll see if it sticks. Trump, of course, is pretty infamous at this point for changing his mind on a dime, but potentially, yes, something that could change the U.S. approach to mediating or supporting Ukraine or whatever it's doing at this point to try and end the war.
So let's talk about this mineral deal that the United States and Ukraine have finally signed.
Yes, there is a... Well, we've talked about it at length. There's been this negotiation going on for the U.S. and Ukraine over Ukraine's mineral deposits, over its fossil fuel deposits. The U.S. basically wanting to exploit those. The Trump administration, Donald Trump in particular, insisting that the U.S. had a right to exploit them in payment for past assistance rendered to the Ukrainians. And that was causing major holdups in these negotiations. The Ukrainians were resistant to the idea that they were paying the U.S. back for past support, or that the U.S. was going to get to basically turn Ukraine into a mercantile colony. There was a breakthrough earlier this week when the U.S. apparently gave up on or kind of put to rest the notion that Ukraine needed to repay the United States for past service. And that appears to have cleared the way for the signing of the minerals deal. The Ukrainian Minister of Economic Development and Trade, Yulia Svitydenko, signed the deal with Scott Bessent, the U.S. Treasury Secretary. They did so over video call on Wednesday. It does establish, as previous drafts had said, it establishes a Ukrainian Reconstruction Investment Fund, where at least some of the proceeds of the exploitation of these mineral resources would be directed. It establishes the U.S. would get preferential access to Ukrainian mineral deposits, fossil fuel deposits, etc. I don't think it's as far reaching into the Ukrainian economy as previous versions have been. It does not, as you know, the Trump administration has been very insistent, it would not include a security guarantee. What they've been arguing all along is that, you know, if the United States is going to exploit Ukraine, it would presumably want Ukraine to continue to exist so that it can be exploited. And that in itself is a de facto security commitment that the Russians should pay attention to if the, you know, the concern is forestalling any potential future Russian aggression, that this these close economic ties would prevent anything like that from happening.
All right, let's talk about Haiti, where the Trump administration has decided to designate local gangs as quote-unquote terrorist groups.
This is similar to what they did back in February. They designated six Mexican gangs and then two other gangs, I think MS-13 and Tren de Aragua in Latin America, as terrorist groups. They're apparently planning to do the same thing. The Trump administration has informed Congress that intends to designate two Haitian gangs, Vivansam and Grand Griff, as foreign terrorist organizations. The administration has shown absolutely no interest in anything having to do with Haiti. It's even removed the temporary protected status that was protecting around 500,000 Haitians in the United States from deportation, so they could be sent back at any time. The only thing I can think that this is intended to achieve is to clear the way for the administration to traffic Haitians in the United States to El Salvador or whatever country. And we can talk about, we'll talk about some of the other options, I guess, in a moment. But whatever country that they're sending people to be thrown into prison at the moment, they will have legal, or they feel legal justification to do that if they make these designations. And then they, you know, claim that migrants are part of these gangs without, of course, due process to prove whether they are or not. They can then just be trafficked off into whatever country the administration wants.
Terrible news. Let's go talk about our neighbors in the Great White North, where the liberals have won the election and utopia is here.
Yes, it's fantastic. Mark Carney, the defender of the left, former central banker. It was somewhat expected. I think that at this point, polling was had flipped on its head in the last couple of months, that the Liberal Party would win Monday's election. The only question was whether they would win an outright majority in parliament or have to form a minority government, which will be dependent on third party outside support for passing legislation. It was the latter, as it turns out. So they didn't win as grand a victory as Carney might have hoped. But the last projection I saw was that they would control just shy of a majority. Carney will be able to form a minority government, but he will need help to pass legislation. On the conservative side, the Conservative Party, having suffered a massive collapse from, you know, leading by double digits consistently in the polls as recently as January, after the resignation of Justin Trudeau and after Donald Trump repeatedly threatened to make Canada the 51st state and kind of drove voters seemingly into the arms of the liberals who were standing up to him. They collapsed, and not only did they collapse overall, but Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Conservative Party, lost his own seat in the election, a seat that he had held for 20 years. But I guess he ran into the Trump effect, and that cost him. He can still remain as leader of the Conservative Party if the party wants him. I'm not sure why they would at this point, but if the party wants him to remain on as leader, he can do that. But he's going to have to ask another MP from the Conservative Party to resign, basically, so that he can run in that seat. He would presumably pick somebody from a very safe conservative district, and then, you know, run to get himself back into parliament so he can, you know, continue on. But yeah, I think, you know, bad night for him personally, bad night for the conservatives overall, not necessarily as bad as it might have been, or necessarily as good as it might have been for the liberals. But overall, not unexpected. And the Trump effect is still working, apparently, in terms of destroying the electoral chances of like-minded parties around the world.
Thanks, Derek. And now let's talk about Trump's firing of his national security friend of the pod, Waltz.
Is he? Is he friend of the pod? I don't know that he's done anything for us, but if you say so.
Not yet. Not yet.
No. Well, third mic's always open, Mike, if you're out there. So, yeah, this is also breaking as we're recording this. Mike Waltz is apparently about to be fired as National Security Council, or National Security Advisor, rather. His principal deputy, Alex Wong, also looks like he is going to be fired. You know, some outlets are reporting this is stepping down, but it seems clear that Trump they're stepping down at Trump's request, let's say Donald Trump's request. This is probably some of the lingering fallout from the so-called Signalgate scandal, wherein a number of senior military foreign policy officials in the Trump administration blabbed about the plans to resume the eternal war on Yemen in a Signal chat that somehow included, oh, I say somehow, it was Waltz who apparently added Jeffrey Goldberg or somebody connected to Waltz, one of his people, perhaps Wong, I don't know, added the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, to this Signal chat and then kind of blabbed about what they were doing. I'm still not convinced that that was a mistake, but who knows? Apparently it angered Donald Trump enough to take this step, even after, you know, in the immediate wake of that scandal, he sort of defended Waltz and said he was fine with the performance of his entire national security team. It seems Waltz is going to pay for this. It's also the case, and I've seen a lot of or a fair amount of analysis to this effect, that Waltz didn't quite align with Trump himself or with many of Trump's, the other officials that Trump has appointed to foreign policy positions. Waltz is very much on the hawkish side. One could argue neoconservative side, but certainly, you know, fellow traveler of the neocon circles, which, you know, Trump is not. He sort of vacillates. I mean, Trump is Trump, I guess. He doesn't really have a core belief system, and he's, you know, bendable on a whim, but he does not typically align, strictly speaking, with the neocon elements of the Republican Party, those that haven't migrated over to the Democrats. And so, you know, the ideological fit was not great. You know, so Trump may have the opportunity to put somebody in this role that is more simpatico with where he's at on foreign policy issues, for example, on the negotiations with Iran, which Waltz was most likely not a fan of. There are other hawkish figures, certainly, in the Trump administration. Marco Rubio could be regarded as a huge hawk. Pete Hegseth, we just mentioned, also a hawk. They're both a little bit more obsequious, maybe, than Waltz in terms of just kind of agreeing to do what Trump wants to get along with him. So they might not be as big of a headache for Trump in that regard. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see who he replaces Waltz with. The early rumors are that Steve Witkoff, who's been leading those Iran negotiations, he's been leading negotiations with Russia. He's been Trump's kind of all-purpose envoy slash de facto actual Secretary of State for the first 3 months of this administration. And if he may be in line, that's the rumor anyway, that he may be in line for this job to replace Waltz as National Security Advisor. He has no experience in that regard, but you know, I guess that hasn't stopped anybody before. So we'll have to see whether this means anything significant for the course of Trump's foreign policy, but certainly it's the first major personnel change, and Trump is known to be pretty quick to fire people, so probably won't be the last. But it is something of a milestone. The second Trump term has already got its first casualty. It's and also kind of takes after the Mike Flynn debacle, I guess, in that he was Trump's first national security advisor and also out very quickly from that job for different reasons, but still.
Yeah, Flynn was out much quicker, like I think 21 days or something like that.
Well, I mean, yeah. Flynn was certifiable. So yeah, I mean, yeah. He was clearly not up to the task. This is a little bit different. There's a scandal. There's, you know, maybe some discord in terms of how they view the world. But yeah, same position, same quick ouster.
All right, let's conclude with the greatest country on earth, and that is, of course, the United States. And let's talk about this thing with Rwanda.
The Washington Post reported this yesterday. The Trump administration is in negotiations with Rwanda, and the Rwandan government is apparently receptive to the idea of, again, trafficking migrants from other countries to Rwanda rather than sending them home, deporting them. They would be sent to Rwanda for whatever reason. It may be that they, you know, they are considered to be criminals in some respect, or the countries that they're from are refusing to take them back, or whatever, for whatever reason, or it's just easier. You know, who knows why they do this with anybody that they traffic in this way. But Rwanda could join El Salvador, where I should note Kilmer Abrego Garcia is still in prison, despite court orders in the U.S. For him to be brought back to the United States to face actual due process. The Trump administration is reportedly, according to the New York Times, sent a note to El Salvador asking or inquiring as to the possibility of Kilmer Abrego Garcia being released and sent back to the U.S. And they were told to get bent, which is probably the answer they wanted. So, you know, that's still in limbo. Donald Trump is busily undermining the administration's claim that there's nothing they can do about his case by telling ABC News earlier this week that he could have Abrego Garcia return with a phone call, but he's just not going to do it despite having been ordered by the courts to do so. So, you know, there's still that situation going on. Costa Rica and Panama have those governments have also suggested that they might be open to certain categories of non-citizen, accepting non-citizens from the United States. Mexico has long been functioning as the front room of U.S. immigration policy, for people who arrive at the southern border, allowing them to be processed and remain in Mexico while that's happening. So Mexico's already in a program like this, but Rwanda would be the latest and furthest away participant in the effort to just traffic people around the world. That seems to be the administration's new approach to this sort of thing.
Well, an uplifting end to an uplifting episode that comes at the end of an uplifting week. Thank everyone for listening. We don't really do this that much, but if everyone could consider liking, subscribing, and reviewing the podcast, only if it's good. I don't want to hear your complaints. Please do so. It actually helps us with the algorithm. So we'd appreciate that. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.